Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Alrighty then, Buzzkillers, you've heard the buzzsaw, and that means it's time for busting myths and taking names. We've been doing this, we've been ruining your day since 1963, and we're glad to do it because we want to illuminate the complications and the fascinating nature of history. Once again with me, one of your favorite professors, Professor Phil Nash from Penn State. How are you, Professor?
Doing great. By the way, am I right? Are we both 1963 babies?
I think we are. I was...
Nice convergence.
I'm April and you're...
July.
Okay,
my mom actually remembered holding me as a very small child and weeping at the news that Kennedy had been assassinated.
I have a similar story, but I don't have quite the details. I think my mother took me in her arms to the next door neighbor because she wasn't sure that the radio had it right in 63.
Right.
And as you can tell, Buzzkillers, we're talking about JFK, and we're talking about JFK because this is the second of our episodes sort of observing the 100th year anniversary of his birth. And we talked a lot about his early life and the early presidency. In this episode, we want to talk more about kind of events and policy.
Right,
and
some of the high points.
And the changing nature of interpretations over time. It's absolutely fascinating the way things are worshipped and then critiqued and then re-worshipped and critiqued. It's on and on and on and on and on. And of course, Professor, you're one of the best people to have here because you've done so much work on things like the very important Cuban Missile Crisis, which is held up as a great Kennedy success, but is really very complicated.
Absolutely right. By the way, can I just insert one of my own favorite personal jokes about this?
There's a personal joke about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Kind of. Because I was actually born about 9 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh.
So I've long speculated that maybe I was the product of post-crisis survival euphoria.
Wait a minute.
It's just a theory. I never asked my parents about it. It's just a theory.
There's something called post-crisis survival euphoria?
There is now.
It's a Nashism?
No. Yes, it's a Nashism. No, it's known to literally a dozen people who have heard this joke before. But yeah, that just makes me wonder, you know, putting myself in historical context like we always do.
Well, and it is important because when we were young, going through elementary school and maybe even into junior high and middle school, we're still in the worshipful Camelot days.
Right. And the Missile Crisis was a centerpiece, no question.
Right. So we're starting with the Missile Crisis, but of course we're going to talk about Vietnam, we're going to talk about civil rights, whether JFK was a conservative or a liberal. These things keep getting restudied and reevaluated, and that's why they're absolutely fascinating.
Yep.
So let's start with a big showdown with Khrushchev.
Sure. Of course, there is another Buzzkill episode on this, which goes into much greater depth.
That's right.
So I would.
We won't promote that as hard as
there you
as
go
heavily as we can.
Isn't that called double counting?
Yeah. Well, why are you exposing these show business secrets?
Another Buzzkill retread. No, but it's been studied a lot. There are hundreds of books on the Missile Crisis, mm-hmm. and I would argue for a good reason.
That's interesting. Okay.
There are still books that come out, and a lot of those reveal new information or explain new aspects of the crisis. We're still learning stuff about it. And I would argue it's justified if only because it's still clear that the Missile Crisis was the most dangerous moment in the Cold War.
Wow.
By a mile. It's the closest we ever came to World War III, which would have been catastrophic. It would have made World War II look like a little weenie roast.
Wow.
By comparison, if you look at the number of dead, even if you had a unilateral U.S. first strike on the Soviet Union, even if a single nuclear weapon didn't hit the United States, you would have had, if you look at the American nuclear war plans at the time,
mm-hmm.
an American first strike would have killed hundreds of millions of people in China.
Which would obliterate the World War II to a death total in an instant.
In an instant. And by the way, a lot of the resulting radioactive fallout would have drifted over the United States.
Ugh.
So the stakes, I mean, you should believe a lot of the hype about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, right.
It
okay.
really was. It's the closest we came to World War III, and World War III would have been a nightmare that you and I can't even imagine.
And when we think about the Cold War, we should remind the Buzzkillers that if you take the Cold War more or less starting in 45, 46, and really going to 85 or maybe 89, that's what, 10, 20, 30? It's a very, very
long time. Right? It's been called by one of my mentors, it's been called the Long Peace.
And
you know, one of the great things about the European unification is that we've avoided another war in Europe with a couple of minor exceptions.
Right.
It's a remarkable thing if you consider the first two world wars were started in Europe and well, arguably started in Europe and came 25 years apart.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the upside of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
In other words, World War III was something we avoided largely because of nuclear weapons, but we came close, and we came closest in the missile crisis of 1962.
And it's one very long stretch of the two superpowers having guns to each other's heads.
Exactly right. Mutual assured destruction. Right. They called it MAD. They called it back in the day. The latest scholarship on JFK and the missile crisis, as I probably said in that earlier episode, really is sort of a mixed assessment. He deserves a lot of criticism. And this was not clear even among historians for a long time. He deserves a lot of the responsibility for having caused the crisis in the first place.
Oh, okay. Caused it. All right.
Particularly because of how threatening his policy was toward the Cuban Revolution, mm-hmm. led by the communist Fidel Castro, who was closely allied with Moscow under Nikita Khrushchev. And it's partly because of the pressure that we had been placing on Cuba, well, even before Kennedy became president, particularly once he became president. If you look at the Bay of Pigs invasion, if you look at Operation Mongoose, this mm-hmm. Very large set of sabotage plans and other policies directed toward Cuba. By the way, at the time, the CIA station in Miami, I think, was the largest in the world.
Wow.
In the United States.
Yeah.
And that's because
all the radar and the listening devices are pointing towards Cuba.
And all the agents were being run out of there, et cetera. Operation Mongoose, which were related to plots to assassinate Castro, I think mm-hmm. we talked about in that other episode. Kennedy was very big on trying to kill Castro. He did not succeed, but it wasn't for lack of trying. There were military maneuvers in the Caribbean clearly directed against Castro. In other words, we were, in retrospect, clearly threatening to the Cuban Revolution. And placing one of the reasons Khrushchev places missiles in Cuba is to protect Cuba against the United States.
Right.
And for years afterwards, you'd have Kennedy veterans and like some of his top advisors saying things like, I mean, why on earth would they put missiles in Cuba? It makes no sense at all. Why mm-hmm. would they do something like this? Mm-hmm. Well, look in the mirror. You've done the same thing in Europe repeatedly. You put missiles in to compensate for a conventional inferiority in the countries who are your allies to protect against the Soviet Union. Why would you expect them to do the same thing?
Yeah, and conventional inferiority, you mean the Soviet Union has a much bigger regular military.
Huge army on the other side of the Iron Curtain, and we couldn't hope to match it in terms of manpower, so we start deploying a lot of nuclear weapons in places like Turkey and Italy and Great Britain and West Germany, and those also appear threatening to the Soviet Union. So why would they turn around and, as Khrushchev famously said, give the Americans a little of their own medicine?
Right.
That's what he does. In any case.
And by the way, just one thing I've been noticing lately, because we've been doing so much work on the image of Kennedy presenting the Cold War and presenting the Khrushchev in press conferences and everything. He always drops the term belligerent. He always drops the term expansion. He's just constantly making sort of insults at Khrushchev, saying he's the guy. He's another little Hitler.
Yes,
who's
he's
do
the
this.
Troublemaker, right? We're a status quo power. They're the ones who are destabilizing. And in fact, it's, as always, more complicated than that.
Our favorite word.
Almost all historians would agree today that Kennedy deserves a lot of the blame and criticism for helping created the Cuban Missile Crisis, or created the conditions for the Cuban Missile Crisis. For a long, long time, this was... is portrayed, even among historians, as completely unprovoked, a crazy, reckless move by Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. And thank God Kennedy was sort of the sane person in the room who sort of controlled this threat without war resulting. We now have excellent evidence on the Cuban Missile Crisis, including lots of secretly recorded conversations from inside the mm-hmm. White House, inside mm-hmm. the so-called XCOM. We have immense documentation. Anyone who wants to write about the Cuban Missile Crisis has to be prepared to plow through an immense literature and an immense amount of documentary evidence.
By immense literature, you mean the work of other scholars have already been done. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Articles and books, which are countless. It would take years to try and get a handle on them. It's clear from this evidence in retrospect that Kennedy was, among his advisors, the voice of restraint.
Oh, okay.
Probably more, because, you know, in the 70s, when there's the revisionism, which we'll talk about in a later episode, there were a lot of critics who thought that he was reckless, needlessly belligerent, et cetera, that he was a warmonger even. Some people on the left accused him of being this, that he was risking war for political reasons, et cetera. It's pretty clear from the tapes, especially on the key day of the crisis, October 27th, that he's the coolest head in the room. He is working hardest to avoid World War III. Now, it doesn't mean the others want World War III, but he's the one who is working hardest, I'll put it this way, working hardest to find a peaceful solution to the crisis. It's clear from excellent evidence, evidence that's better than we have in most every other case, taped, in other words, secretly taped conversations. Mm-hmm. Not at first. Early in the crisis, he actually is in favor of an airstrike to take out the missiles, which could have escalated into war.
Sure, sure.
But I find it interesting, in December 1962, a couple months after the crisis, he gives this long and very important TV interview with a couple of journalists.
Yeah, yeah.
And they ask him, what's the most important lesson you derive from the missile crisis? And his immediate response is that we had enough time to talk this out internally.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I think that's interesting, because when you put that together with the fact we know now that there's an article about this called Belligerent Beginnings. In other words, his initial inclination was an airstrike.
Okay.
And then they talked it out and he found out some of the problems, and then he went with the blockade of Cuba instead of an airstrike.
Okay. So what he's saying is that we had enough time for the XCOM, that is the committee he created,
to secretly deliberate
and change his mind.
Right. And that's what makes me scared about today. Like, if we had a similar crisis today, would a president have enough time to secretly sort of staff this out, game this out, and come up with the right policy? With our 24/7 news cycle and the internet and leaks and things, I really wonder.
And shows like this. we're always breaking news here.
If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. But in other words, we have a very different decision-making environment today, and not for the better, I would argue. But in other words, I thought that was interesting, and we've put those two together.
Yeah.
My guess, I'm speculating again, my speculation is that he's obliquely referring to the fact that he ended up in the right place, but had he had less time to decide, he might not have ended up in the right place in terms of the decision he makes.
Well, without saying so directly, in that interview, he is sort of implying, or at least recognizing within himself, that that's what happened.
Right.
Well, fortunately for the Buzzkillers, we have the audio from that interview. It's a very famous interview. And we're going to play that clip, the section Professor Nash is talking about, it right now.
A conversation with the President of the United States. Last evening in his office, Mr. Kennedy looked back at the first 2 years of his presidency and looked ahead. Talking with him for some 90 minutes were three White House correspondents: Bill Lawrence of ABC News, George Herman of CBS News, and Sander Van Oker of NBC News. Now on the CBS television network, an hour of that conversation, edited and recorded on videotape.
As you look back upon your first 2 years in office, sir, has your experience in the office matched your expectations? You had studied a good deal, the power of the presidency, the methods of its operation. How has this worked out as you saw it in advance?
Well, in the first place, I think the problems are more difficult than I had imagined they were. Secondly, there's a limitation upon the ability of the United States to solve these problems. We are involved now in the Congo in a very difficult situation. We've been unable to secure an implementation of the policy which we've supported. We are involved in a good many other areas. We are trying to see if a solution can be found to the struggle between Pakistan and India, with whom we want to maintain friendly relations, yet they're unable to come to an agreement. There is a limitation, in other words, upon the power of the United States to bring about solutions. I think our people get awfully impatient and maybe fatigued and tired and say, we've been carrying this burden for 17 years. Can we lay it down? We can't lay it down, and I don't see how we're going to lay it down in this century. So that I would say that the problems are more difficult than I imagined them to be. The responsibilities placed in the United States are greater than I imagined them to be. And there are greater limitations upon our ability to bring about a favorable result than I had imagined them to be. And I think that's probably true of anyone who becomes president, because there is such a difference between those who advise or speak or legislate and between the man who must select from the various alternatives proposed and say that this shall be the policy of the United States. Well, it's much easier to make the speeches than it is to finally make the judgments, because unfortunately your advisors are frequently divided. If you take the wrong course, and on occasion I have, the president bears the burden, responsibility quite rightly, the advisors may move on to new advice.
Well, Mr. President, that brings up a point that's always interested me. How does a president go about making a decision, like Cuba, for example?
The most recent one was hammered out really our policy and decision over a period of 5 or 6 days. During that period, the 15 people, more or less, who were directly consulted, frequently changed their view because whatever action we took had so many disadvantages to it. And each action that we took raised the prospect that it might escalate with the Soviet Union into a nuclear war. Finally, however, I think a general consensus developed and certainly seemed after all alternatives were examined that the course of action that we finally adopted was the right one. Now, when I talked to members of the Congress, several of them suggested a different alternative when we confronted them on that Monday with the evidence. My feeling is that if they had gone through the 5-day period we had gone through it, looking at the various alternatives, the advantages and disadvantages of action, they probably would have come out the same way that we did. I think we took the right one. If we had had to act on the Wednesday in the first 24 hours, I don't think probably we would have chosen as prudently as we finally did, a quarantine against the use of offensive weapons. In addition, that had much more power than we first thought it did. Because I think the Soviet Union was very reluctant to have us stop ships which carried with them a good deal of their highly secret and sensitive material. Another, one of the reasons I think that the Soviet Union withdrew the IL-28s was because we were carrying on very intensive low-level photography. Now, no one would have guessed, probably, that that would have been such a harassment. Mr. Castro could not permit us to indefinitely continue widespread flights over his island at 200 feet every day. And yet he knew if he shot down one of our planes that then it would bring back a much more serious reprisal on him. So it's very difficult to always make judgments here about what the effect will be of our decisions on other countries. In this case, it seemed to me that we did pick the right one. In Cuba of 1961, we picked the wrong one.
So, Professor, that's a fairly powerful self-evaluation of his own presidency.
Sure. I mean, at the time, sort of public discussion of presidential leadership really didn't get any better than that.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
Very, very, very reflective.
Yep. In any case, so he's the voice of the restraint. He refuses the airstrike. He cuts a deal. We now know, we started figuring this out in the 1980s, that he cut a secret deal. That there was a public deal.
Right.
He pledges not to invade Cuba. Secretly, he agreed to give up NATO missiles in Turkey and Italy. It was a secret part of the deal, which was successfully covered up for many, many years. There were myths involved. There's this myth of the eyeball-to-eyeball moment at the U.S. naval blockade where at the last minute Soviet ships turned around. That's now been debunked. Soviet ships didn't get anywhere close to the blockade before they turned around. That was not the risk of World War III. The risk of World War III was elsewhere in the crisis.
And so the whole shot across the bow thing, we've talked about this before, but it didn't happen.
Never happened.
And they were in the mid-Atlantic. They weren't even close to Cuba
right,
when they turned around.
Yeah, it was hundreds of miles short. By the way, we have pretty good evidence from the Soviet side too these days, which we didn't always have. We have a lot of Soviet and Cuban documents now. And the evidence there also is that Khrushchev, once the crisis starts, Khrushchev is sobers up metaphorically and is also very, very restrained.
Right.
And what you have is in effect, not by intent necessarily, but in effect, you have these two leaders sort of getting their act together and agreeing to avoid World War III at the expense of their allies, the Turks and the Cubans, respectively. Yeah. Khrushchev does not consult Castro before he agrees to give up his missiles, and Castro is absolutely livid.
Oh, sure.
He starts using some real choice words.
Yeah.
Not fit for young buzzkillers.
No. Didn't translate him, you'd figure it out.
to refer to Khrushchev. And Khrushchev, it takes months for Khrushchev to patch up that relationship, including inviting Castro to come visit the Soviet Union in 1963, which he does.
That's one of the important points you made in our major episode about the Cuban Missile Crisis is that ultimately, because they had time to think this through, JFK and Khrushchev got their big boy pants on,
right,
and didn't react emotionally.
That's right, and even overruling or going against some of their advice they're getting from some people who have less responsibility and are a little more bellicose and a little more careless, I would argue. As Ari also argued in that episode, if these cooler heads did prevail, so the risk of war was low, right? A lot of the latest evidence suggests that the risk of war was not a deliberate war, but an accidental war.
Oh, right.
And we have all sorts of evidence on both sides of, these are both very large and complex military establishments, and a lot of things go wrong, especially in a crisis. things that go wrong that are accidental get interpreted by the other side as possibly deliberate. And the risk of war by accident was a lot worse than I think a lot of people understand.
Oh, that's just almost too hard to comprehend.
It is. Well, and the idea that you might have a president or a Soviet leader who are on it, doing everything they can to avoid World War III and fail to avoid World War III because of these military establishments and standard operating procedures and just boneheaded mistakes and people who didn't get the memo, right? Mm-hmm. JFK famously said there's always some son of a bitch who doesn't get the word.
Yeah, and pushes the button.
Exactly. Or someone who thinks they're under attack and so they launch their missile without any orders, and that act, not the prior act, which didn't exist, that act starts World War III. This easily could have spiraled out of control despite the best intentions of the two leaders.
Well, what's so interesting, one of the many things that's so interesting about all this, that during the tension of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Vietnam exploratory war is going on and ramping up.
Right. Now, the war has technically not been Americanized, quote unquote. And by that I mean we have not sent in large numbers of ground troops who actually engage in combat on their own. That doesn't happen until March 1965.
Right, when Johnson's president.
There were Americans on the ground in South Vietnam who did engage in combat.
Yeah.
They weren't supposed to, the first, but they often did in their very active advisory role. On the Vietnam Memorial, the first American name that's on that wall is from 1959.
Oh, under Eisenhower.
Under Eisenhower. So there were Americans killed in Vietnam. There were Americans killed in 1945 in Vietnam at the end of World War II.
Yeah, okay.
It's a big issue among historians, sort of JFK in Vietnam, especially when you look at the documents we have now from the last 6 months of his presidency, where it's pretty clear he may want to get out of Vietnam.
Right.
And there have been entire books written on this. There are historians, some of them very responsible, who argue that Kennedy would have withdrawn us from Vietnam, or certainly wouldn't have Americanized the war the way LBJ did.
Right, and would it probably have done it after the 64 election?
That's the claim, that after the 64 election, he would have had, and that often happens, right? You have more breathing space as a politician, especially in your second term. You're sort of unfettered.
And in the early part of your second term, people aren't thinking about that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are documents where Kennedy is laying the groundwork for a withdrawal.
Uh-huh.
That's quite clear. That doesn't necessarily mean we would have withdrawn.
Oh, sure, because as you said with Cuba, early on he's thinking of airstrike, but then he changes
his mind. Things change, right? Because a lot of these documents from the fall of 63 also basically are predicated on success.
Right.
The war was going very badly in the fall of 63. It's one of the reasons why he okays a coup by South Vietnamese generals who overthrow Ngo Dinh Diem, who's the South Vietnamese president, basically from the country's inception, 1954-55. He was our ally. The Kennedys had become so fed up with him for various reasons we don't need to get into, but the only people who can remove him from power are the South Vietnamese generals, who are also concerned about the course of the war, and they won't act without America's approval. Kennedy gives his approval. Diem is overthrown November 2nd, 1963, just 3 weeks before Kennedy's own death. Diem is overthrown and assassinated, to JFK's horror, by the way.
Yeah.
By the way, one of Nixon's minor misdeeds is that when he's in the White House, he has people like E. Howard Hunt forge documents that suggest that Kennedy actually ordered the assassination of Diem.
Oh, for goodness sake.
When in fact he did not. And by the way, and we have very good evidence from multiple sources that Kennedy was truly shocked. He wanted Diem out of the country, sort of in exile.
Yeah.
He did not want him assassinated.
But if Nixon's doing this about someone
who's long dead. Yeah. And it's part of Nixon's Kennedy obsession, actually.
And it's
bizarre.
Very least a waste of time.
Yeah. Among other things. Yeah. Really bizarre. In any case, so if this withdrawal was predicated on future success, well, future success didn't happen. A lot of people, including probably Kennedy, assumed that once you get Diem out of there, things will improve. Well, they didn't.
Yeah,
he's followed by a string of inept generals who do no better job prosecuting the war against the Viet Cong, and no better job creating a stable, prosperous South Vietnam, and things just get worse and worse and worse. As a basic historical issue, I would argue we need to judge presidents by what they did, not by what they might have done.
Right.
Is it possible Kennedy would have gotten out of Vietnam? It's entirely possible, maybe even plausible. compared to Lyndon Johnson, for example, he was clearly, especially after the missile crisis, clearly more self-confident in terms of his sort of position in foreign affairs, right?
Especially since the missile crisis is trumpeted as a great success for Kennedy.
For Kennedy, he has great credibility, great sort of reputation for strength. He, for example, unlike LBJ, is much better positioned to say no to his advisors.
Right.
Because remember, it's a lot of Kennedy's advisors like McNamara and Bundy and others who are saying, yes, we need to Americanize the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah.
His Harvards, as LBJ referred to them.
And then McNamara later, when he convinces LBJ of that, is considered one of the great war criminals by the protesters anyway.
Absolutely right. Yep. There's a lot of blame to go around here. So, yeah, maybe Kennedy would have realized that Vietnam was a mistake, but we don't know. We have to remain agnostic on this issue, it seems to me. If you look at Kennedy's actual record between 61 and 63, what he does in Vietnam, it's quite clear what he did was he's deepened the American involvement and the American commitment to South Vietnam.
Okay, okay.
And by any measure, if you look at the amount of economic aid, if you look at the amount of military aid, if you look at the number of U.S. military advisors, it goes from about 1,000 when Kennedy enters office to about 16,000.
Wow.
I mean, partly that shows you how the Vietnam problem is getting worse, right? The Viet Cong is growing in strength. Larger sections of the country are controlled by the Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. It's a weak, feckless, and brutal regime in Saigon all at the same time. It's
wow.
a big handful for the Kennedys. I don't envy them that problem. But if you ask the question, what did he do with the American commitment to Vietnam? You know, does he belong in the long string of American presidents or doesn't he? My answer is yes, he does.
Yeah, yeah.
He started with Truman. It's continued by Eisenhower, but our commitment grows and grows and grows, especially after the French pull out and sort of wash their hands of the problem in 1954. And there's this sort of South Vietnamese state created. Mm-hmm. We want to hold the line in the Cold War, and Kennedy is in the long haul more part of the problem than part of the solution. If you judge him by what he did.
Right, right.
As opposed to what he might have done.
And we can't judge him on what might have happened from November 24th onwards.
Yeah. You can show me all the memos from before November 22nd that you want. It doesn't prove, quote unquote, what he would have done. It's a counterfactual. We can make good guesses. Counterfactual analysis is very, very useful. I'm a big fan of it. Mm-hmm. But we can't judge him by what he might have done.
Okay, so this not only sort of undercuts the Kennedy would have saved us from Vietnam myth, but this segment of the show, we've also shown how the Cuban Missile Crisis isn't as clear cut as it might be in the popular Camelot imagination.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
like with most presidents, very few of these things are all black and white.
Right. And these were the two big, two of the biggest Cold War issues at the time. So that foreign affairs is, as you say, a mixed success, but also, you know, these wars, or the big war wasn't started.
Right.
So that's something.
And also, let me just add that Vietnam was not the biggest issue facing him in 1961 when he comes into office.
Things like
Cuba and Berlin and also Laos, often overlooked, are much bigger issues than Vietnam. But Vietnam starts to move up the ranks as the situation gets worse.
Yeah, and if you just look at the rhetoric from the 60 campaign from both sides, Nixon and Kennedy's side, the words Cuba, the words Berlin come up all the
time. Absolutely. Vietnam, not so much. Not in 1960.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's take a break then. We've handled foreign affairs. Now we're going to take a break to hear from one of our sponsors, and we'll go back into domestic affairs when we get back. Buzzkillers, you've been listening to us upstairs talk about JFK and the scope of his political career, the successes of his political career, the complications of his political career, but I can tell you one thing for certain. JFK was able to become a successful politician and a successful president because of Harry's razors. We've talked about it on Twitter, we've talked about it on InstaFace, and we've talked about it here on the show. But Kennedy won the West Virginia primary in 1960 over Hubert Humphrey. Why? Because he used Harry's razors. He looked better than Hubie. He won the famous presidential debates over Nixon in the fall of 1960. Why? Because Nixon didn't use Harry's razors, and JFK did. And of course, the election went that way. While he was president, Kennedy stared down Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You remember Khrushchev and his nasty Soviet stubble? JFK not only looked better, he felt better, he acted better, and he acted more presidential because of Harry's razors. Harry's five-blade razors have that great soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide, trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places, and another president, Lincoln, used that, lubricating strip to make things go so smoothly, and a textured handle for more control when it's wet. I love Harry's razors. And I love them because big ripoff razor companies have been charging us a fortune for hundreds and hundreds of years, and two great buzzkillers out there, Jeff and Andy, decided enough is enough. They formed Harry's Razors. They bought a fantastic razor factory in Germany so they could make their blades themselves and cut out the middleman and sell them direct to you. They charge a fraction of what the ripoff razor companies charge. And those good buzzkillers at Harry's mail the razors right to you on a regular schedule that you set up with your membership. Not only that, in the middle of 1963, JFK said to the people at Harry's, "Look, I want you to have a special offer for buzzkillers." And so they set that up. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. You'll get your razor, get your five-blade cartridge, and the shaving gel. And by the way, Lady Buzzkill loves the shaving gel. It has a wonderful aroma. You just pay a pittance, $3 for shipping. Enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout when you go to harrys.com, and you'll get the post-shave balm for free in addition to all this other stuff. The post-shave balm is great. It's another thing that Lady Buzzkill loves. You'll look better. Your face will feel better all day. You can act presidential. You can have the successes that JFK had. Subscription plan is, of course, customizable in terms of shipping frequency, and you can cancel anytime. Let me repeat that, buzzkillers. Go to harrys.com, enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout. You'll get everything that JFK had, the razor, the blades, the shave cream, and the post-shave balm for free. Do it now. Start enjoying a whole new world, a whole new frontier of better and more affordable shaves. harrys.com, code at checkout, BUZZKILL. Now back upstairs. Back upstairs we are here in the Research and Broadcasting Department of the Institute. And Professor, so much of what is talked about in terms of JFK successes is that he may not have solved things, but he certainly started things on the right path. And I'm thinking about civil rights. That's a very big issue, not only for Eisenhower in the late 50s, but it gets more intensified, and then, of course, even more intensified after that for LBJ. What is the sort of understanding and the interpretation of historians about JFK's civil rights record?
Right. And it's I think in most cases, it's pretty mixed once again. I think in the popular imagination, I think a lot of people might think of him as sort of a civil rights president, which is only really true in the last year of his presidency.
Okay, 63.
In 63. And before that, I don't think he deserves very high grades. And in fairness to him, this is a politician. First of all, domestic issues were not as important to him as foreign policy issues generally.
Right, right.
You know, presidents are, like LBJ, for example, is the opposite. LBJ was not a foreign policy president.
Sure.
Whereas JFK was.
Yeah.
No question about that. Also, from his, just in terms of his upbringing and his sort of social class and all his experiences, race just was not an issue for him. He had very little exposure to African-Americans and the African-American issue in American politics. He didn't have a lot of contact with black people. It was just it was the same with poverty, by the way. These were just not on his radar screen. They weren't priorities for him. That changed.
He understands them intellectually, but they don't have the emotional attachment that they did for LBJ.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. Absolutely right. LBJ, these were real to him. JFK, much more abstract. He does in the 1960 campaign place an important phone call. I think it's in October 1960, MLK is arrested, not for the first or last time.
Martin Luther King. One of the problems with the 60s is it's so everyone's got these initials and everybody runs around with JFK, MLK, LBJ, RFK.
You have to whip out your decoder.
Nixon doesn't seem, people don't,
RN, but, you know, RMN, no.
Doesn't seem to resonate with the people.
Not so much. Poor Dick. Yeah. But yeah, so, and the Kennedy campaign, after much deliberation, places a phone call basically on Martin Luther King Jr.'s behalf. Martin Luther King Jr., by the way, by 1960, the acknowledged leader of the civil rights movement.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Huge name. And the Nixon campaign doesn't.
I see.
But the JFK campaign does.
Okay.
And, you know, in retrospect, it's not a huge thing. It's not a really bold stance, but it actually kind of mattered in 1960. Because remember, a fair number of African-Americans still consider themselves Republicans. It's the party of Lincoln, after Not all of them have turned to the Democratic Party. They did start to under FDR for lots of good reasons. But that he gets some credibility with the black community with that one step. So he gets at least a little bit more black support in the 1960 campaign for that act. But the real story happens, of course, once he's in the White House in 1961. And for the first 2 years plus of his presidency, I would argue he does not deserve very high marks in civil rights. It's not a priority for him. His administration is very reactive.
Okay.
In fairness, they're putting out a lot of fires. The civil rights movement is kicking into high gear and causing a lot of crises. If you look at the freedom rides, you know, the integration of the interstate busing. If you look at some of the attempts to enroll African Americans in Southern universities, sometimes this requires the deployment of National Guard or federal marshals. There are some great risks involved here, but he and his brother Bobby, who's attorney general, they're very reactive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very timid. And partly, I would draw the parallel to Franklin Roosevelt, who was also very timid on civil rights. And partly, you have to sort of acknowledge that they do have a political problem, which is the disproportionate power of Southerners in Congress.
Especially Southern Democrats.
Southern Democrats. Who, now let's remind the buzzkillers, to this day, our Congress, a lot of its routine business is done through committees.
Yeah, absolutely.
And committee leaders it's based on seniority. And by 1960, a lot of the committees in Congress, both houses, are dominated by Southerners because they've been there longest. Because they, in their one-party Democratic South, if you're an incumbent, you're never challenged.
And just remind them that this is a long hangover from Lincoln was a Republican, Republicans in the Civil War. So they're Democrat almost at birth.
Yes, and the contested elections in the South for decades were Democratic primaries.
Right.
In fact, they were all white primaries. Black people are not allowed to vote in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had these sometimes very old, very conservative, very racist Southerners who dominated some of these committees and had the position under FDR and under JFK to bottle up legislation, including unrelated legislation.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
So to the extent that we can legitimately explain JFK's timidity on civil rights, it's because he needs Southern support for some of his other agenda.
Yeah.
And is terrified that if he goes too far in the direction of civil rights movement, he will jeopardize this support. And that's a legitimate fear.
Mm-hmm.
How legitimate, that's up for debate.
Right. Especially for how legitimate, considering that he's concentrating an awful lot on foreign affairs.
Exactly. And has a lot on his plate, no question about it. Counterfactual, if JFK is assassinated in late 1962, his historical record on civil rights would not be very strong.
No.
It just wouldn't. Things change in the spring of 1963 when you have the civil rights movement protesting in Birmingham, which is this famous or infamous incident where the German shepherds and the fire hoses are trained on not just protesters, but children who are protesting.
Yeah, and caught on film.
Caught on film, heavily reported in the North. It becomes an international issue, often overlooked. This was an international embarrassment in the United States, who's trying to win over some of the new countries, many of them in Africa.
Yeah.
In the Cold War, this is just yet another black eye.
Why should we side with the United States when you're doing this to our descendants?
You talk a good game about freedom and equality and look at the newspaper, look at the television footage.
Yeah. It's newsreels.
A lot of people, it's a nightmare just for the State Department, not just for the U.S. government.
Pressure's coming from all sides.
Lots of pressure. And by the way, this reveals sort of the fundamental dynamic of the civil rights movement, which always needs to be kept in focus, which is the federal government only does the right thing when it's forced to.
Yeah, both in 57 with Eisenhower and then later.
In 57, in 63, in 65 with LBJ and the Voting Rights Act, it's the same basic dynamic that the government has to be forced by a crisis created by the civil rights movement into action. It won't do it on its own. That's certainly true of JFK in the spring of 63. Birmingham is such a big deal and such a powder keg that he basically bites the bullet, goes on national television June 11th, 1963.
Yep.
Perhaps we can play a clip.
We have it queued up, ready to go.
It's a great speech.
I think it's his best speech. It really is something.
It's terrific. In other words, it's not just boilerplate. It's not him. I've been dragged kicking and screaming into promoting civil rights.
Yeah.
He clearly has sort of had his come to Jesus moment.
Okay.
When it comes to civil rights.
Well, here we're going to play an important section of that speech. So down to the audio visual department.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This afternoon, following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro. that they were admitted peacefully on the campus is due in good measure to the conduct of the students of the University of Alabama, who met their responsibilities in a constructive way. I hope that every American, regardless of where he lives, will stop and examine his conscience about this and other related incidents. This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. Today we are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free. And when Americans are sent to Vietnam or West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only. It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops. It ought to be possible for American consumers of any color to receive equal service in places of public accommodation, such as hotels and restaurants and theaters and retail stores, without being forced to resort to demonstrations in the street. And it ought to be possible for American citizens of any color to register and to vote in a free election without interference or fear of reprisal. It ought to be possible, in short, for every American to enjoy the privileges of being American without regard to his race or his color. In short, every American ought to have the right to be treated as he would wish to be treated, as one would wish his children to be treated. But this is not the case. The Negro baby born in America today, regardless of the section of the state in which he is born, has about one half as much chance of completing a high school as a white baby born in the same place on the same day. One third as much chance of completing college. One third as much chance of becoming a professional man. Twice as much chance of becoming unemployed. About one seventh as much chance of earning $10,000 a year. A life expectancy which is 7 years shorter, and the prospects of earning only half as much. We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free. We preach freedom around the world, and we mean it. And we cherish our freedom here at home. But are we to say to the world, and much more importantly, to each other, that this is a land of the free, except for the Negroes, that we have no second-class citizens, except Negroes, that we have no class or caste system, no ghettos, no master race, except with respect to Negroes? Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. The fires of frustration and discord are burning in every city, north and south. Where legal remedies are not at hand, redress is sought in the streets. in demonstrations, parades, and protests, which create tensions and threaten violence and threaten lives. We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. It cannot be met by repressive police action. It cannot be left to increase demonstrations in the streets. It cannot be quieted by token moves or talk. It is a time to act in the Congress, in your state and local legislative body, and above all of our daily lives. Next week, I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law. The federal judiciary has upheld that proposition in a series of forthright cases. The executive branch has adopted that proposition in the conduct of its affairs, including the employment of federal personnel, the use of federal facilities, and the sale of federally financed housing. But there are other necessary measures which only the Congress can provide, and they must be provided at this session. The old code of equity law under which we live commands for every wrong a remedy. But in too many communities, in too many parts of the country, wrongs are inflicted on Negro citizens, and there are no remedies at law. Unless the Congress acts, their only remedy is the street. I am therefore asking the Congress to enact legislation giving all Americans the right to be served in facilities which are open to the public, hotels, restaurants, theaters, retail stores, and similar establishments. This seems to me to be an elementary right. Its denial is an arbitrary indignity that no American in 1963 should have to endure, but many do. I'm also asking Congress to authorize the federal government to participate more fully in lawsuits designed to end segregation in public education. We have succeeded in persuading many districts to desegregate voluntarily. Dozens have admitted Negroes without violence. Today, a Negro is attending a state-supported institution in every one of our 50 states. But the pace is very slow. Too many Negro children entering segregated grade schools at the time of the Supreme Court's decision 9 years ago will enter segregated high schools this fall, having suffered a loss which can never be restored. The lack of an adequate education denies the Negro a chance to get a decent job. The orderly implementation of the Supreme Court decision, therefore, cannot be left solely to those who may not have the economic resources to carry the legal action or who may be subject to harassment. Other features will be also requested, including greater protection for the right to vote. But legislation, I repeat, cannot solve this problem alone. It must be solved in the homes of every American, in every community across our country. In this respect, I want to pay tribute to those citizens north and south who've been working in their communities to make life better for all. They are acting not out of sense of legal duty, but out of a sense of human decency. Like our soldiers and sailors in all parts of the world, they are meeting freedom's challenge on the firing line, and I salute them for their honor and their courage. My fellow Americans, this is a problem which faces us all, in every city of the North as well as the South. Today, there are Negroes unemployed 2 or 3 times as many compared to whites, inadequate education, moving into the large cities, unable to find work, young people particularly out of work without hope, denied equal rights, denied the opportunity to eat at a restaurant or a lunch counter or go to a movie theater, denied the right to a decent education, denied almost today the right to attend a state university even though qualified. It seems to me that these are matters which concern us all, not merely presidents or congressmen or governors, but every citizen of the United States. This is one country. It has become one country because all of us and all the people who came here had an equal chance to develop their talents. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right, that your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have, that the only way that they are going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that. Therefore, I'm asking for your help in making it easier for us to move ahead and to provide the kind of equality of treatment which we would want ourselves, to give a chance for every child to be educated to the limit of his talents. As I've said before, not every child has an equal talent or an equal ability or equal motivation, but they should have the equal right to develop their talent and their ability and their motivation to make something of themselves. We have a right to expect that the Negro community will be responsible, will uphold the law, but they have a right to expect that the law will be fair, that the Constitution will be colorblind, as Justice Harlan said at the turn of the century. This is what we're talking about, and this is a matter which concerns this country and what it stands for. And in meeting it, I ask the support of all of our citizens. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're back from the audiovisual department, where we had the recording from the Oval Office from 63, and we're here on the research and broadcasting section of our own Buzzkill Institute.
Wait, they were merged?
Yeah, they were merged, yeah.
Because of budget cutbacks.
Yeah, that's right. Buzzkillers don't want to see our budget, trust me. But what's always impressed me, Professor, is when you look at, for instance, Eisenhower's 57 speech on Little Rock, it's all about the president must act because the Supreme Court has ruled this and the Constitution must be enforced. It's very much, we must do this for the way the system works. It doesn't mention morals. And then Kennedy sort of starts out that way in this speech, but then he switched to this, we were confronted by a fundamentally moral issue.
Right.
And that's a big shift.
Right. It's basically a snapshot of a president in transition.
Absolutely.
I think that's the way I would put it. Because you're absolutely right. Eisenhower, worse on civil rights. Not just reactive, but extremely conservative. And really does, you're absolutely right. He does it because it's about his, by the way, he felt like personally betrayed by the governor of Arkansas.
Yeah.
But also because he feels like he has no choice but to uphold the federal courts and their decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's dragged, kicking and screaming. JFK.
But he does do it.
He does do it, and he does the right thing, and it does anger a lot of Southerners.
Yeah.
But JFK before this is more in that mold. JFK is more like, well, I guess I have to do this because it's a question of law, but it's not a moral issue. Mm-hmm. It's not my priority. I prefer the cells just to go away, basically.
Yeah.
But the events in Birmingham really sort of are a tipping point for him. And like I said, if you listen to that whole speech, and I urge Buzzkiller to do it, This is not just his good speech writers, and this is not sort of him okay, I guess we better do something. It's almost like he's a different president on this issue.
Yeah.
And so, and by the way, and in the speech, he says, I'm going to introduce a civil rights bill, which he does. And it's not identical because it goes through some changes, but it is basically the core of what becomes the 1964 Civil Rights Act, signed into law by LBJ July 1964. And it is the dagger in the heart of Jim Crow segregation. It outlaws segregation in all public accommodations. In other words, any business. So remember, this is private property.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And you can still see signs that say, we reserve the right to refuse service to anybody.
Yeah.
That was a lot of the state's writers back then said, listen, my private property, I can serve whomever I like and dismiss those I like, right? In other words, but if it's a restaurant, a movie theater, anything that serves the public, you must now accept everyone. This was a watershed. I mean, this was a big deal. Now, he didn't get it passed.
Right.
In his lifetime. He didn't have political strength. He didn't have all the troops lined up. He's still not entirely sort of squeaky clean on civil rights. If you look at all the machinations surrounding the March on Washington, which happens in late August 1963, that's where Martin Luther King Jr. gives his famous I Have a Dream speech, right? This massive movement, massive demonstration, I should say, a quarter of a million people at the Lincoln Memorial, right?
Yeah.
One of the most famous speeches in American history.
And one of the most famous images of the civil rights movement.
Yeah. Behind the scenes, it's my understanding that JFK was not entirely happy about this march. And I think I'm right in saying that he even tried to put the kibosh on it.
Yeah.
And then when it was happening, he tried to work behind the scenes, sort of control it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, people like John Lewis, who's now in Congress, who was head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at the time, he had prepared a very hard, critical anti-Kennedy speech.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And people in the movement, people like A. Philip Randolph, who organized the event or helped organize the event, he was certainly the original inspiration. He and others prevail on John Lewis to tone it down, to take out some of the more inflammatory language.
All right.
And I'm pretty sure that the Kennedy White House is also working along these lines. In other words, trying to manage this thing that they, you know, they're not in charge of this. This is not a Kennedy event.
Right, right, right. Even though they invite Martin Luther King to the White House and he shakes
afterwards,
his hand.
Afterwards, right.
And I have the same dream sort of thing.
Right, and that's partly because he realizes how powerful and successful the speech was. And was watching it at the time and was genuinely impressed by it. I mean, he wasn't lying. But, you know, there's still a transition going on. He doesn't manage to pass the bill, partly because it's just taken a long time to get through Congress and has to undergo some changes. And of course, there's a struggle between the Southerners and more liberal Northern Democrats, right, to try and shape or block the bill. In a way, this is going to sound perverse, but in a way, the assassination of Kennedy helps the civil rights bill.
Yeah.
Because LBJ ruthlessly takes advantage of Kennedy's death to help pass the bill. And basically says, you know, we have to honor our fallen king by passing this legislation. He pulls out all the stops.
And passes the Voting Rights Act in 65
as well. In 65 as well, right. So LBJ is the one with the clout and the political skills and the momentum who can actually put these major civil rights bills into law. But Kennedy starts the ball rolling in 63, and he deserves a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, and it just to harken back briefly to what we said before, and it is LBJ who then takes the ball up as a moral concern, or
absolutely,
at least rhetorically does so.
Oh, yeah. If you look at his speech in March of 65 on behalf of the Voting Rights Act, where he actually uses the words, "we shall overcome," which blows everybody away,
sure,
including people in the movement who are just shocked that any president of any kind would ever say those words.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty impressive. LBJ, but yeah, very different politician in a lot of ways.
Right, right.
And one of them is he has the political skill.
Sure.
And the arm twisting skills.
Yeah.
He also has a growing federal government and a lot of goodies to bestow or deny in terms of like
states,
dams and bridges in districts, et cetera, which any president today, I mean, people wonder why our government doesn't get stuff done today. One of the many reasons is presidents just aren't as powerful as they were back then.
No. If they did that sort of arm twisting and strong arm, you're not going to get this dam in Tennessee because you didn't vote for the civil rights.
That's right.
It would be exposed.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and also, and then, like I said, they just don't have those gifts to bestow. Whereas LBJ had the gifts and he knew how to use them.
Yeah. Well, this brings up fascinating sort of, if you will, final topic or wrap up topic, even though it's going to take us a long time to flesh it out about, well, you know, lots of people talk now about JFK really being a conservative. Sometimes you see this thing on talk radio, well, he was a big tax cutter and therefore he's a conservative, but also he has this liberal mantle from way back when. It's complicated. I think one of the problems is we try to force people from the past into the boxes we have now of liberal and conservative, and liberal and conservative meant different things. So how does that work in terms of the way he's interpreted by experts?
And in terms of his place in history and his legacy, a really important tell, a really important indicator.
Yeah.
Right? You know you have achieved iconic status when you are routinely invoked by both political parties.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
These days I'd put Reagan in this category.
Yeah,
because you can find Democrats like Barack Obama with nice things to say about Reagan and trying to invoke him. Kennedy, for a long, long time, has been repeatedly invoked by both presidents. George W. Bush invoked Kennedy in the lead up to the 2003 Iraq War.
Reagan did a little bit, yeah.
Reagan did. And in recent years, there have been more serious efforts to sort of claim JFK and his legacy for the conservative side.
Hmm.
There are two recent books. I'll just give the titles. One is called JFK Conservative.
All right, yeah.
Not a lot of ambiguity in that claim.
They're flying the flag there.
There it is. And there's another one called JFK and the Reagan Revolution.
Right.
As far as I understand, books with similar arguments, basically trying to claim JFK as a conservative.
Okay.
Now, a little bit of context. It is certainly true that JFK did not emerge from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party circa 1950 or 60.
Right, the Stevenson-Humphrey.
Even if you look at domestic priorities, even LBJ,
even though
he's a Southerner, I mean, in terms of like priorities and where they are in the party, he's in the middle or more on the conservative side.
Hmm.
He has to do what I'll call liberal outreach in the 1960 campaign. He's always concerned about building ties to the liberal wing of the party, and because he recognizes that the liberals in the party don't really trust him.
Is that because they think, well, if we're going to vote for a conservative, will just vote for Nixon.
You could do that. And also, they look at his record in Congress and the Senate, which they don't see any great liberalism there. They see that he's a son of Joseph P. Kennedy,
yeah,
who is not at all liked by liberals.
And still alive.
And still alive, right? To put it mildly. I've got other choices in the Democratic Party. Why would I back this guy, mm-hmm. Kennedy, who's mm-hmm. not a true liberal?
Well, and as we've said before, not on the show, but, you know, my parents, the Duke and Duchess, were certainly Humphrey people. And, you know, there are a lot of people, a lot of
my parents
rock were, solid Democrats were not Kennedy people.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you want a true sort of New Deal leading into the Great Society style liberal, JFK is not your guy.
Right.
One would make that argument. It's also true that he was a rather militant anti-communist.
Yes,
you know, because a lot of people on the left wing of the Democratic Party at the time, they're the ones talking about a nuclear test ban. They're the ones talking about dialing back the Cold War and the arms race, right? They're sort of proto-peaceniks in a way, a mm-hmm, lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas JFK is a hawk on foreign policy when it comes to defense spending and confronting the Russians, et cetera. He's a hawk.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly true that as president, he promoted a very big defense buildup.
Yep, yep.
Partly because any Democrat has to do that to protect their right flank. Just like, by the way, and also not just to touch on Vietnam again, one of the reasons why he, to some extent, LBJ to a greater extent, they don't want to be the president who lost Vietnam.
Yeah,
they both, they were both in office in on Capitol Hill in 1949 when we quote-unquote lost China. And they saw how disastrous that was for the Democrats and the Truman administration. They didn't want to repeat that. And it's a legitimate fear. And so any Democrat has to worry about their right flank because right after the McCarthy period, you have to worry about what Republicans are going to do. It's one of the reasons why LBJ Americanizes the war in Vietnam. He's terrified what's going to happen.
Sure, sure.
You know, and that's why I always have to laugh when you look at how much credit someone like Nixon gets for the opening to China. He deserves some, of course. It was a bold diplomatic move, but let's remember Richard Nixon, before he was president, was the kind of Republican who made it impossible for Democrats to do the same kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you'd be accused of being soft on communism.
And by that stage, when he does it, it's not as controversial.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always they view Nixon as sort of this miracle worker, which I've never completely understood. In any case, so he is partly protecting his right flank, but he's a moderate Democrat.
It's
also true that as president, he sought a big tax cut, and that was a big piece of his domestic program, was a mm-hmm. tax cut, mm-hmm. which a lot of Democrats were not pushing for at the time.
Right.
That's the kind of thing, especially that today conservatives hang their hat on, partly because tax cuts are such a major part of the conservative program today.
Just about any
Republican politician today favors a massive tax cut. And I actually listened to part of it. This was several years ago. Someone like Rush Limbaugh, I think, did multiple episodes, including playing long excerpts of a speech Kennedy gave in December 1962, in which he's defending his tax cut, and in which he sounds like a real pro-business conservative.
Sure, yeah.
So a couple things. First of all, I would argue this is, in effect, a commando raid on history, where you basically—
Rush Limbaugh's not in good enough shape to do a commando raid on anything.
Metaphorical
except
commando.
Except the red refrigerator.
Well, maybe if he gets sufficiently hopped up, you could do it. But in other words, you go into the past and you cherry pick one historical episode or piece of evidence and you bring it to the present and use it for your current purposes.
And this could be done on the other side by just cherry picking the civil rights speech.
Lots of people do this on all issues at all times. It's always a pitfall, no question about it. But first of all, he's giving the speech in front of an audience of business people.
Yeah.
So he's at pains because he's trying to bring them on board for this and other policies.
Right.
Course he's going to sound like this. At other times, he sounds like other people, like most good politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, he is clearly, everyone who writes about this says that JFK was a convert to what's called Keynesianism, Keynesian economics.
Right.
Named after John Maynard Keynes, famous British economist. Who basically argued already at the time of the Great Depression that the way you solve a Great Depression is you engage in massive deficit spending.
Yeah, the government borrows money and spends it.
Borrows money on an immense scale.
To kickstart the pump. Kickstart the engine. Prime the pump.
Prime the pump. Here in the mixed metaphor department of the Buzzkill Bunker. But basically, in other words, you don't worry about deficits short term.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is exactly what we did. Keynesians would say, look, it's what we did in World War II.
Yeah.
Massive deficit spending, which, what do you know, ended the Great Depression. And then you worry about the deficit later.
Yeah.
When you revive the economy.
And in theory, the economy gets so going so well that the tax revenues eliminate the deficit.
Right. And not just in the dire circumstances of a Great Depression, but even when your economy is growing, but you want it to grow faster, JFK would say, look, you stimulate the economy, even at the risk of deficits, and you worry about the deficits later. In other words, because you had deficit hawks at the time, like you do now. And so he argues for a tax cut. Now, it's my understanding that his tax cut was not what we would call a supply-side tax cut. In other words, where you cut mostly on business, hoping that they then famously trickles down.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that you put more money in business pockets, they invest it, they create jobs, and that stimulates the economy. His is much more of a demand-side tax cut. In other words, you focus much more heavily on income tax cuts across the board so that consumers, as we would call them today, spend money at the bottom to stimulate the economy.
Oh, okay.
Well, so right there, even I don't want to get too deep in the economic weeds, but right there you have a problem, right? Because the people extolling JFK today for being in favor of a tax cut are almost all supply-siders.
Oh, right.
Even in that narrow context, they're pulling him out of context.
Okay.
He also did not worry about deficits, and he did not cut deficit spending. Didn't cut government spending at the time.
Okay.
Because he's a Keynesian. You can go ahead and cut taxes, and don't worry about the hole it blows in the budget. Continue to spend a lot on defense and a lot on social programs, and it'll all work out.
And the latter things are anathema to modern conservatives.
Exactly right.
Right, right.
So in other words, you're just telling half the story, and that's just on the tax cut. In the bigger picture, if you look at his record, and even on foreign affairs, it's more complicated, and you can't really claim he's a conservative. He had far more liberal preferences when it comes to his domestic agenda.
Okay, we'll get to those after this word from our partners at the EcoSoap Bank. Buzzkillers, are you aware that global hygiene is in your hands? The people at EcoSoap Bank are aware of it. Clean water, proper sanitation, and personal cleanliness are among the most important factors in keeping poor families healthy in the developing world. Yet, 75% of rural families in Cambodia lack access to the most basic hygiene products, including soap. So EcoSoap Bank is doing something about it. They partner with hotels and guest houses in Cambodia to collect the partially used bars of soap left behind by the estimated 3 to 4 million tourists that pass through that country each year. The discarded, non-biodegradable bars are purified and recycled into new soap bars that are then distributed to rural schools, clinics, and slum areas. To date, the EcoSoap Bank has recycled 26,000 pounds of soap and served 667,000 people through its distribution program and its hygiene classes. The Buzzkill Institute is committed to helping this great project by contributing $1 for every Buzzkiller who donates to the EcoSoap Bank. Go to ecosoapbank.org/donate and type Buzzkill, 2 Z's and 2 L's, in the comments section of the online donation form. A donation of just $25 provides soap and hygiene education for 250 Cambodians, recycles 35 pounds of soap from the hospitality industry, and it supports ongoing employment of local people in Cambodia. It's as easy as that, Buzzkillers. A simple act to fill a basic need. Okay, Professor, let's take up that domestic agenda. If we're talking about liberal preferences, what are they?
So things he wanted to put through if he had the opportunity or had the political strength or
right.
the right environment. Federal aid to education, Medicare, a minimum wage hike, civil rights bill. These are all things that would have been favored by liberals at the time.
Right.
Almost all of them, if not all of them, opposed by conservatives at the time.
Okay, so that's a pretty big stake in the heart of the idea that JFK is a conservative.
Yep. From the documents, we also have a pretty good idea of what he was planning to do after his 1964 re-election.
Okay.
He already was looking forward, by the way, to running probably against Barry Goldwater and had a good sense that he was going to win.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, it was too early to tell for sure, but he felt good about
that. Almost anything could have happened.
Right. And so he's already planning. So what are we going to do once I get re-elected? This includes things like creating something called the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD.
Yeah, which becomes an LBJ thing.
He also plans an attack on poverty.
Oh.
Now, maybe not a war on poverty, but an attack on poverty. And so if you look at this list I've just laid out before and so from during his presidency and what he plans for post-64, it sounds a lot like LBJ's Great Society program.
Okay, so that's eye-opening for me, because I think of LBJ's Great Society program as mostly a product of LBJ's mind.
Now,
LBJ's
right.
Now, political ideas.
LBJ probably would have done it on his own anyway.
Right, right. Okay.
It's not like he's saying, well, I have my hands are tied, I have to do what JFK wanted. But
yeah,
there's a lot of convergence there. Not 100%,
okay,
but I'd say 80%.
Well, that's significant. That's
in other words, I mean, if you look at that list, if you look at that, if you run this thought experiment, if JFK is allowed to pass all the domestic legislation he can,
right,
what will that look like?
And that's the Medicare, the minimum wage hike, the civil rights bill, the federal aid to get
even a more liberal program than the 1960 candidate JFK would have been okay with.
Wow.
In other words, I would argue that if anything, he's moving to the left.
Okay.
I wonder certainly if not sitting still or moving to the right.
This is sort of like the JFK, the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's had time to think about all these things. He's had his first term to work out all these things, and he's
been exposed to the two big issues of the time, race and poverty, right? Like even in the 60 campaign, he first experiences poverty when he tours West Virginia, and he's shocked.
Yeah.
But in other words, and I think he's like LBJ in that he has a sense of possibility, right? We're a very powerful and rich country. Let's get busy using the power of the government to solve some of our basic problems. In that regard, he's a lot like LBJ and not at all a conservative. Most of these things would be anathema conservative. By the way, and it's also true on foreign policy issues.
Yeah.
You know, at the time he has, you know, this reputation for being a tough guy who stared down Khrushchev in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But let's not forget that his greatest accomplishment in foreign policy as he saw it was the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963.
Right. Oh, yes.
Which limited nuclear tests in the air and the atmosphere and underwater. That was his crowning achievement. He was most proud of that.
Yeah, because that, if it's held to, is something for forever, you know, hundreds of years.
And something that dials back the arms race, right?
In other words,
here's how you actually have something to show for the space that's been created by your quote-unquote victory in the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? Now you can afford politically to take some risks for peace, which he does. And which, by the way, was opposed by conservatives at the time.
Oh, yeah.
They thought this was unilateral disarmament.
Effective appeasement.
By the way, in that same year, 63, not as big an issue, but this is when we first start selling grain to the Russians. And when we establish the hotline between the teletype hotline between Washington, D.C. and Moscow. In other words, he's making some, if you look at, by the way, the day before the civil rights speech, if you look at his famous American University speech.
Yes, yes.
Where he talks about, we're all mortal, we all breathe the same air.
Yeah.
Right. When it's a lot of conservatives not happy with that speech.
It's almost like Julia Ward Howe and her, you know, disarmament movement after the Civil War.
Kinda. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then, you know, anyone can cherry pick. If you go back to 1960, you can find JFK saying some pretty liberal things.
Right. Okay. And we have, in fact, a clip, a very famous clip where JFK not only defines what conservative and liberal mean at the time, but defines of what he thinks is liberal. The audio is not perfect on this, Buzzkillers, but it's pretty good.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with a taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Well, you can't have much more clear example of nailing your colors to a flag than that one.
Right. Now, once again, you know, you're going to say slightly different things to different audiences.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right? But on the other hand, you can't go too far in one of these directions,
yeah.
Right? I mean, if you say, yeah, I'm more liberal than anybody. In fact, I'm virtually a commie or whatever. If you say something like that, I mean, that's gonna hurt. So yes, in the one sense, he's doing liberal outreach. On the other hand, if you look at what he stands for when he actually sits down and maps out his domestic agenda, it's pretty liberal, right? Yeah. Something like a minimum wage hike, you will search a long time before you find a conservative willing, by the way, who even is okay with the concept of a minimum wage hike at the time, much less someone who wants to jack it up.
And he talks about that a lot during his presidency. He comes up in press conferences over and over again, and he really is strong on it.
It's a big issue, and it's a priority for him. So, I mean, for every issue where you can find he's on the conservative side, I would say you can find 10 where he's on the liberal side.
Oh, well, then the balance is clear. Yeah. The scales and the balance have spoken.
Right. And like I said, to the extent that there's movement, it's in a liberal direction. It's not in a conservative direction.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, Professor. Thank you so much. And we've discussed not only his early life and an earlier life and early presidency in our first episode on this. This really gets in deep on the major issues of most of his presidency. And with the next episode, we'll talk about his legacy.
Right, the history of the history.
Talk to you next week.